When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck. I'm Owen Slott and delighted to welcome you to a special futuristic version of the podcast where we are given a unique glimpse of the future. Where will the game be in 20 years' time? How long will the tackle stand until it is banned? When will club rugby usurp the international game? In 20 years' time, will Italy still be coming last and will Eddie Jones still be scaring the life out of Reece Patchell? The reason we know the answers to such matters is not because tried and tested, much-loved Ruck regular Alan Dimmock is with us. Hello, Al.
Hello.
But because we finally managed to secure an audience with observer, writer and co-founder of Sport 500 website, Mike Aylwin, also known as rugby's Captain Clairvoyant. Hi, Mike. How are you going?
I'm very well, thanks, Slotty.
If all this sounds preposterously baffling, please hang on in there. It will become clear. This is also the day after the end of week two of the Six Nations, and there is quite a lot to look back on, too. So, Saturday, I was at Twickenham. Al, where was your weekend?
I was in Dublin for Ireland versus Italy.
And, Mike, where were you?
I have just touched down from Edinburgh.
So, with seamless organisation and administration, the Ruck has got every single game covered. Player of the weekend. I didn't put that on your homework,
did
I?
I've got a team of the weekend, like you asked.
Thought it was Owen Farrell by just stand out by a mile. But
I thought Owen Farrell was fantastic. I think Joel Launchbury got pretty close.
Well, I will, being boring, focusing on the same game and indeed team, go for Mike Brown.
And was it a try? Okay.
Ooh, right.
Let's just get straight onto it. Was that a try? Did Gareth Anscombe touch it down? If you look at the response in the media since then, largely directed by Warren Gatland, this is the biggest scandal of all time. It's getting close to you're being brave if you put your head above the parapet and say, oh, I'm not sure, actually.
It's not the biggest scandal of all time. I mean, that's a laughable suggestion. I'm sure Warren Gatland's not really saying that.
But do you think is it black and white, or do you think there's some grey areas?
I think it looks as if it probably was a try, and that's because of the photograph that has since materialised, where it does look, even though we have to be careful about these freeze frame pictures, it does look as if he's got two fingertips on the side of the ball. It's not even on the top of the ball, it's on the side of the ball, but it is on the upper side, and if there's any traction in his fingertips, it's quite possible he's got downward pressure. But to expect the TMO he didn't see that photograph, and from the first question was asked, which means, is it a try, yes or no, the onus of proof is on the attacking team.
What do you think, Al?
Glenn Newman is having a hell of a day already today, the TMO who made the decision. Because if you look at freeze frame images or slow-mo pictures from it down, you could say, right, it looks like there was a kind of downward pressure there, but, oh, actually, was there a fingertip?
Yeah.
I mean, a knock-on from
all
there,
this talk
is that
of fingertips.
Maybe at the top?
I mean, it's desperate. It's so tenuous.
Mike, if this was the year 2144, then we would have all the technology.
They would know, because there would be pressure pads underneath the pitches and they'd know exactly what downward pressure, if any, was exerted.
Yeah, what a rubbish world we live in where we haven't got that stuff.
There'll be pressure pads in the ball as well.
The TMO would be 3D as well. You'd be able to get the full 360 of the, and underneath the
ball.
Well,
we could, I mean, you know, all we need is some jazzed up version of Hawkeye, and that would solve all these problems.
Jesus, Mike, why aren't you in charge?
The onus of responsibility is probably the bigger talking point here, is that Glenn Newman, we're unlikely to see him again for Six Nations purely because of the furore around this whole decision. We're unlikely to, probably, he'll have responsibilities taken off because the decisions are made.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if he had other games lined up and if those are taken
away. He's not due again on this Six Nations, I don't believe.
I don't think.
But if you rewind to the World Cup when Craig Joubert was the villain in chief for basically whistling Scotland out of the World Cup, Al, you won't disagree with me on that. he was, amongst the media, he was the man everyone wanted to see or get a picture of or have him skulking out of Heathrow Airport with a false moustache and a baseball cap pulled over his face. But no one even knows what Glenn Newman looks like. I mean, he's just this fictional rugby villain now.
Well, the thing is hasty is probably a word you could use to say for the decisions made. Would he have come to a different conclusion had he at pains gone over it for 3 minutes? Who knows?
It has to be clear and obvious, though, for the first question. Well, in fact, the second question has to be clear and obvious as well. But for the second question, it has to be clear and obvious proof that a try wasn't scored. And if the second question had been asked, they probably would have awarded it. But the first question was asked, which means they have to prove that there was downward pressure. And from the angles he had, I think there were two angles. I didn't think it was obvious.
What do we think Glenn Newman is in his past? I mean, is it Mother English? Is there a Granny Gate thing involved in
here? Are you suggesting that there's scurrilous?
No, I'm not. I'm just playing with the idea of this faceless this faceless man who's dominated
the
whole conversation.
That's the nature of this TMO now, and I think it's probably just as well he is faceless, and it's a shame that referees can't be faceless. They will be in the 22nd century, by the way. Rugby will be refereed by computer.
Okay, listen, on that bombshell. Sorry, I don't know how to move beyond this. I promise anyone who's still listening at this stage, we will explain why this conversation's going that way before you're done.
Can we talk about something else actually here? Can we talk about the try saving tackle from Sam Underhill?
I mean, I know we're excited about this, but in even more exciting, we have Ben Kay on the line, who is a newcomer to this podcast. Ben, great to have you on the podcast. Now we've had 2 weekends of the Six Nations. How do you see the balance of power at the moment?
I think you'd probably say that Ireland are just shading it in terms of being favourite, but it's very difficult to predict with those two Italian games because you'd have expected Italy not to be able to put together as strong a showing away from home. Ireland looked very free-flowing. I think that's the key about the Six Nations. It's about getting the momentum. England haven't quite got that momentum off the back of their performance this weekend. But you know, it's very close between those two. But England have some pretty tough games coming up, having to go away to France and to Scotland. But I think we're all hoping that it might come down to a decider on the last day at Twickenham between England and Ireland.
Well, it's looking increasingly like that, don't you think?
You just can never be 100% sure. You know, that rugby's a funny game where you can get those shock results, and you know, Scotland will be trying to direct the style of game next time out to play into their favour, and I think England will be doing absolutely everything they can to ensure that it's not the style of game that Scotland wants.
Ben, this is Alan Dimmock, who's got a far more intelligent question for you than I have.
Well, hi Ben, how are you? England this week are training with Georgia over Tuesday and Wednesday. Eddie Jones has talked about how he thinks that they're one of the biggest, strongest, ugliest scrum packs in the world. Do you think that says much about how England intend to play against Scotland, or is this just one of those things where you think the opportunity came up and they jumped at it?
Probably a little bit of both. I think England will want to make it a very physical game, and particularly around the scrum, they'll want to in the sort of training that you probably can't do against each other, even live with the squads that you have. So just having that different styles and you know, just test you. And the thing that Eddie Jones has always done is take his players out of the comfort zone. And you know, to be honest, if you ask any of the players without Eddie there, they'd probably say the last thing they feel like doing is training against Georgia this week. But that's what he does, you know. And it's that old adage of train hard, fight easy, make what you do in training harder than what you're going to face on the pitch, and you know, it'll all seem easy on match day. So I think it's very very wise of Eddie, and it just keeps, you know, one of the big sort of criticisms maybe of England in 2015 was that everything had become a bit samey, and you know, they were at Penny Hill all the time. Eddie's moved them around different venues, and he's brought in various different teams to train against, and it means you never settle into that comfort zone of the same old, same old. And every time you turn up to an England training session, it's going to be different.
Eddie's week was characterised by his comments on Rhys Patchell and Alwyn Jones. And I just wonder what your view on that is, having been on both sides of the media and as a player. Did you find that just part of the way that thing rolls at the moment, part of the entertainment, if you like? Some people think it's entertaining, or do you find that there is a limit that he may have overstepped?
I think we know enough about Eddie Jones now to know that he doesn't really care what we the media think of how he's doing it, but I think it all is calculated. He spoke to Ali Eakin when he first got the job in an interview and said, it's partly the entertainment value. I'm trying, you know, it's a bit like boxing. I'm trying to generate as much interest around the sport. But equally, he said, more than anything, to his own players, it's the messages that get back to his own players. And he highlighted the fact that actually most rugby players, particularly around the Six Nations, probably don't read any media, but just those messages that might get back through friends or family, you know, it's more his own players that he's worried about than anyone else. He doesn't care about anyone else at all. I would have liked him to have at least not acknowledged it after the game and sort of said something about Rhys Patchell and stuck up for him a little bit. I don't think Patchell had a great game, but it would have been nice if Eddie maybe had stuck up for him. But he doesn't care. All he wants to do is win for England, and he's been pretty successful at that so far.
Just as a former player, what impact does that sort of thing happen to, what does it make on the players themselves? I mean, in many ways, you could argue that what Eddie Jones is doing is cranking up the pressure on his own team, because he's almost saying beforehand, this is what we're going to do, and I'm over to the players now.
I think in some respects he is, and he doesn't mind cranking up pressure on his own players and seeing how they react. And he just likes to throw a few hand grenades, doesn't he? But equally, what Eddie's very, very good at, which reduces the pressure on his own players, is controlling the agenda of press conferences. He comes in and talks about what he wants to talk about. And for any of, you know, Martin Bayfield before the Italy game, he had to have about 100 questions ready, because Eddie will only answer the questions he wants to answer. So he'll give you a one-worder, and then he'll find one that he can say what he wants to say, and he'll open up on that question. So he wants to be in total control of the messages he's getting out there. From a player's perspective, you know, Clive and Eddie obviously used to have a fair few battles in the press. And if you speak to Clive, he said they were really good mates, but it was almost fun. They were having a bit of banter with each other and throwing in these hand grenades, and the press had all run with it. We didn't really, as I said, players don't tend to take that much notice of the media. And actually, it was only when Clive came into the team room and said, you'll never guess what Eddie Jones has been saying about us. And that was just used as motivation to wind us up. So everything that he does, I think, is calculated. And the fact that we're all talking about it now probably shows that he knows exactly what he's doing. And as I said, it's working. England are winning. I noticed that the Irish press are a little bit upset this week about Joe Schmidt maybe not being as open as he has been in the past. So maybe it's a new trend in coaching.
Or maybe us media just getting our knickers in a twist about what people should say or what we deserve to hear. That's one opinion that I have as well, actually. Ben, if you could read Eddie Jones, which you can't, if you could predict what he's going to do next, which you can't, you'd say, well, he called out Rhys Patchell and quite arguably got under his skin. He certainly achieved what he hoped. So you would say, well, therefore, England-Scotland, Finn Russell is a player who has no form at the moment, it would appear. Is the obvious target? Would you expect him to do that? No, you wouldn't, because he doesn't do the expected. But
yeah, exactly. You can't read it, but I'd probably expect him to go the other way and talk up what a great player Finn Russell is. say, oh, it's just a blip, and he expects him to be the match winner this weekend and put pressure on him that way.
Ben, for the rest of the championship, Scotland win a game. The Scotland media immediately afterwards are asking Gregor Townsend, does that mean that we can win the Six Nations? Do you see a possibility of Scotland or Wales creating some damage still?
Wales might quietly go about it. I mean, there is very much the potential that anyone could lose a game, so it could come down to who's put in the best performances and who gets the most number of match points and actual scored points as well to who wins it. I think Scotland will struggle, and the only reason that I've said that all along, just because of the fixture list this year. You look at where they've got to go and the teams that they've got at home. I just thought that Scotland might. But having said that, they turned the game around yesterday, came out with a victory. I thought that might be one that they lose, just with that huge French pack. It nearly was the case, but they will be much more confident now. But I just think that the fixture list for Scotland has been particularly hard this year, and I think if they do win the Six Nations, it will be an enormous achievement just with how that pans out, because it does make a difference where you have the games against the best teams.
Mm-hmm. Ben, brilliant. Listen, thanks for coming on. You did the England game at Twickenham on Saturday, and then you're so much in love with your art that you went and covered the Harlequins Wasps game over the road yesterday.
Don't forget Bath on Friday night as well. I love rugby.
And the Bath.
Can I stop talking about rugby now, please?
Okay, you can. Listen, thanks for coming on. Great to talk to you.
All right, cheers, guys.
Okay, so Ben says that players don't care what we write. I'm not prepared to acknowledge that we're as insignificant as that. Anyway, moving back to Sam Underhill.
Well, I just think it's worth talking about, because it's a positive thing, no matter which side you support to talk about. Incredible tackle is an incredible tackle, and there's so many moving parts of it, literally moving parts. If Scott Williams had dived a little bit later, or if he passed, if Sam Underhill had been a half a beat later or too early, if either of them had gone higher or lower in their jump, we'd have been talking about a try. But Sam Underhill has managed to pull out an incredible try-saving tackle, and I just think that's one of the positive things from that game that's worth us talking about.
What I love about it is the kind of improvised nature of the tackle. I mean, it's unlike any tackle you would normally see, because it was the only option he had, and he managed to compute it all in, you know, so quickly to sort of grab the guy's shorts and roll him over onto his back and out. It was the only way he was going to stop it, really, because when a player's sliding along the floor, you can't really perform a conventional tackle anyway. So to have got there in the first place was extraordinary for a back row forward who must have been exhausted, and to have had such clarity of thought and precision in the execution when he got there was worthy of saving the try.
Mike, if this was 21-44, then we would know the answer to the next question: is what would have happened if he hadn't made that tackle? Because we're at that point of the game where Wales was starting to get a toehold in there. If they'd scored that try, it would have gone up to 12-8 and then maybe 12-10. Then we'd have seen England under real pressure rather than the slight cushion that they had until the 75th minute. We'd have seen a different game.
I felt England were in control of that game throughout.
Al?
I think it would have been closer, a lot closer. I think England probably would have just edged it.
It would have been fun to see them under that pressure, wouldn't it?
When points are scored, dynamic of the game changes. And England, for better or for worse, had always had Wales at arm's length. They were more than a score ahead from the 20th minute. And they didn't have to. I mean, I know they should have finished Wales off, but the bottom line is subconsciously they knew they didn't quite have to. The sense of urgency was therefore perhaps lacking, and I think it would have been reinstated had something happened like Gareth Anscombe had been awarded his try, or if Scott Williams had scored his.
Okay. I would like to say I agree with you, Mike. I thought England did have control. I think the 9, 10, 12 were they were the cogs that ran the show, and they put, I mean, a lot of focus has been put on the fact that they kick so much better than Wales, but there's a reason for that, which is the Welsh kickers were put under so much pressure, and when they were kicking, it was because they needed, that was the only option going, or they were under pressure or whatever, and they were needing to clear their lines, etc. They didn't have the time to dominate and run the game like that.
Two things. First of all, I think England's game is basically in good working order. I don't think they played very well on Saturday, but I love the Ford-Farrell thing. I love the layers of attack that they send into opposition defences. I think they were lacking in precision, discipline-wise and skill-wise, which is why they kept turning the ball over. But it is also worth pointing out, Wales were missing so many players, and to have come as close as they did and to have stopped England scoring after the 20th minute was a phenomenal achievement for pretty inexperienced team.
You're listening to The Ruck, and we are back after this.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Ruck. And don't forget, you can sign up for the brand new Ruck email. Subscribers can go to thetimes.co.uk/bulletins.
Al, hot-footing it from Dublin. So, yep. we you know, a month out, we're all busy matching up England against Ireland, assuming that it might happen, and it is getting closer, that sort of the double Grand Slam playoff at Twickenham. This was Neil Francis in the Irish Independent this morning. Neil Francis, former Ireland lock and now columnist for the newspaper. He said, "Italy experience a nightmare that visits me from time to time. You all know it. It's the patient on the operating table and the surgeon begins to operate on you without any anaesthetic. This happened to Italy yesterday. They were awake and fully conscious and yet they couldn't move and couldn't do anything to prevent what was happening to them. They could see the doctors in surgical gowns. The scalpel appeared and the surgeon proceeded to remove their colon without any pain relief." I mean, just
interesting. You asked about England versus Ireland, and almost predictably, Sergio Parisse, after the game, the captain of Italy, was asked, "Well, you've played against England and you've played against Ireland now. Who do you think has the better chance? Who plays the better rugby?" Yeah. I heard some Irish journalists suggest he may have been playing to the gallery when he suggested that Ireland are playing the better rugby at the moment. I suppose he's not really in a position to assess who's the better because Italy have taken a spanking off of both of them. Italy have conceded 15 tries in the last two games, 7 against England, 8 at the weekend against Ireland. And Neil Francis has put it very colourfully, but there were points, certainly in the first half, where Sergio Parisse must have been turning around going, "Well, how the hell did that happen? They've just scored again." It felt like Ireland could lay up. After 50 minutes, they took the halfbacks off. They made a couple of substitutions at halftime. They conceded 3 tries in the second half, but by that point, the game was out of touch.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't matter. So Ireland could actually afford to rest key players like Sexton and Murray.
But the point sort of works the way he put it, in that Ireland seem to be more clinical about the way they go about things, don't they?
Yes, but against Italy, remember, they didn't look like scoring a try against France.
I was in Paris for that France game and they did not. I mean, they threatened once off first phase in the first half. I say threatened. I mean, they got to the 22 with a nice move and they won a penalty there. But that was about the only time they forced France into conceding, in that case.
So, Mike, if you're reading the tea leaves, if you're looking into the future again, and we're only going to go forward a month, who's ahead out of England and Ireland at the moment?
I think England looked imaginative in both games. Ireland didn't in the first, but I don't think that really matters either. I think the most important thing is the nerve that Ireland showed in that last 5 minutes, that extraordinary 41 phase without making any mistakes and then nailing that drop goal. I mean, that showed Absolutely. Serious cojones, as I think they call it. England haven't quite been put in that position yet, and it'll be interesting to see if they can respond in the same way.
It's going to be a nervous week for fans of Ireland this week, because they're going to have to wait and see how things pan out with Tadhg Furlong, who went off between 3 and 4 minutes in that game against Italy. Italy's not a game where you'd expect a key player to go down so early. He looked like he was struggling with a hamstring injury. It's a case of wait and see how he goes. He is vital for those big games. He's the one, probably one of the, with the exception of Johnny Sexton, is probably the most important player that they would want playing against England in any decider.
He's the one player in the Ireland team that you could say and you'd tough to argue that he's not the best player in his position in the world.
Absolutely. And it doesn't help as well that Robbie Henshaw, who scored the brace, went off with his arm in a sling. He was meant to have a scan yesterday. Communication with Ireland at the moment is hard to tell where he is with that, but he could be another big loss, because he's really turning into a serious player for Ireland as well. So there's question marks over that, but I agree with Michael in that the nerve that they showed against France in a game that, for a lot of people, against other teams, they would have not won that game. They've managed to eke out a win somewhere, somehow. Yeah. And then they opened up the throttles against Italy and managed to find scores. I love how you said England are looking more creative. One of my favourite moments of that game was watching Conor Murray jump in the line out and take a ball against Italy. It's something he's done a couple of times for months of the season. That actually led to 2 tries. Now, he popped the ball down and it hit one of his teammates in the face, and it didn't actually lead to a try scoring opportunity. But I love moments of invention like that. That's one of those little things.
Yeah, but are they not a bit gimmicky, that sort of thing? I mean, it's against Italy. Is he going to try that? Maybe he will try that. Yeah,
we've seen in big games little plays like that open up.
Maybe because Joe Schmidt's always 3 moves ahead, isn't he? So maybe he's done that in this game, so people will think, when they put Conor Murray in the middle of the lineup for the England game in Twickenham, everyone's going to go, "Oh, we've got to mark him," and then they'll throw it over the back. Anyway, from Dublin to Edinburgh, Mike, I wasn't really remotely convinced that Scotland was suddenly the Scotland we thought they were in the autumn.
No, well, I mean, they've still got this extraordinary flakiness about them, this lack of concentration. I mean, it's best exemplified, obviously, by Finn Russell, who, if any player embodies the team he's in, he's the guy. It is actually quite infuriating. They remind me of Harlequins at their most annoying. I mean, constantly trying to be brilliant. And we all love teams who try to be brilliant, because what would any sport be without brilliance? But sometimes you can't be brilliant the whole time, and you've just got to, you know, slow things down and be sensible occasionally. And Finn Russell, both games, has just trying to work miracles every time he gets the ball, and it just doesn't work. And
so when Finn Russell lets his team down, doesn't put a penalty kick out, or completely squiffs another one, or makes another just infuriating error. I was watching him. He smiles afterwards and laughs at himself. And I don't. Well, what do you guys think of that? Because for me, the body language is not. It's a nervous thing.
It doesn't look good.
But it doesn't sell well to the rest of your teammates, I'd have thought.
Okay, what I would say is, after he went away on holiday in the summer after his flirtation with the Lions squad, I did a feature, interviewed him, I phoned him up, and he was on holiday in the Highlands of Scotland. And
he was one of the Geography Six.
He was one of the Geography Six. And one of the things he said to me was, rugby's a game where, as long as I have a smile on my face, everything's going to be okay. So I think I agree with you, that's a nervous thing. He'll have been annoyed with himself and he's trying to get over it, but also that's just the way he plays rugby. People are going to have to get used to this. We've seen this for years with Danny Cipriani, where everyone went, he's going to have to tighten things up and try and stop doing miracle things and carrying so flat to the game line. It's like, no, you're just going to have to accept the kind of player he is. You either work with it or you make provisions to make a decision. Now, at the weekend, Gregor Townsend did make provisions. Greg Laidlaw, after the game, seemed a little bit surprised that he had had a run at fly half.
Well, apparently it was struck upon in the morning, very morning.
And it was something that they'd done a little bits and pieces with during the week. But he threw Le Petit General in at 10 and let Laidlaw play at fly half and said, right, Finn, it's time to go. There's other amounts of this. I'd say Scotland will be delighted to get the win. John Barclay is captain. At some point, I don't know why he didn't say, can we get Stuart Hogg or Greg Laidlaw to kick to touch now, please? You know, that would have probably cut out that problem and said, Finn, calm down. Just focus on your game. You don't worry about the set plays or anything like that. Let's just see what happens with you go.
Looking to the future, sorry to coin a hackneyed old phrase on this podcast, but Finn Russell at Racing next season, I'm not sure that that's going to do him any good. He's going to be overplayed. He's not going to be looked after the way he is in Scotland at the moment. I'm not sure that he's going in the right direction.
Some mischievous folk have even suggested that it's the Racing deal that's a bit gone to his head a bit. I don't know if that's fair at all. I'm not on the inside track there. But
if you put Laidlaw in, well, anyway, if you put him in at 9 instead of Ali Price, but then you suddenly move him to 10, are you then saying, hello, this is pragmatism and the romanticism of the new Scotland game is just going to be apart for a while we try and win with something?
Well, they have played with Laidlaw at 10 before. I mean, it's not that long ago, within the last two or three seasons. I quite like him at 10. He's obviously, being a scrum half, got great distribution. He can kick. He's sharp, creative, but he's just a bit more sensible. And I know the romantics in us should always relish people like Finn Russell, but the trouble is the pragmatists, i.e. the international coaches, cannot build a credible international team of substance around that because they have to have the other way to play.
Here's the thing as well, is we're talking about that as if that's what will decide potentially, if that's what will shape the game against England. Scotland's, and now you have to accept that, particularly with Finn Russell being as flaky as he is with the ball off his boot, Greg Laidlaw has to play. Because he kicks points.
Yeah.
So Greg, if you say that Greg Laidlaw has to play, then you go, is it that important whether he plays 9 or 10? Really, what has affected Scotland in the last two games is the fact that they do not have the rambunctious ball carriers to blast holes and create go forward so that they can distribute. That game against France was won purely because France were infringing so often at the breakdown. They put phrases together, it was fantastic. And the injection of David Denton in particular helped a lot in that he just said, I'm coming for you, I'm coming right at you, and you've got to tackle me. Scotland have missed that the week before, completely. And that is where the difference will be. Whether they have quick front foot ball with the defence retreating to play with. Can you see that against England? That's the question.
Yeah, but who's England's ball carriers? I mean, you know, without Big Billy, they don't have an obvious punishing cutting edge either. But what they do have is generals who can throw a beautiful 20-yard pass off either hand, but also can just squeeze you until, you know, the pips burst.
I wouldn't be surprised if Ben Teo is not back in to answer your question.
Well,
for the game.
Yeah, quite possibly.
But they've got, well, Joe Launchbury is actually probably their most effective ball carrier at the moment, isn't he? It was sensational at the weekend.
I think they missed Sam Simmons as well when he went off at half time. I mean, he's not a, you know, he's not going to scatter people, but he's so quick. Another dimension.
I'll keep saying this about Sam Simmons as well. He's got good feet for a big man. But it was interesting to see Chris Robshaw hacking down at number 8. That's something I can't remember seeing before.
So he became a 7.5, didn't he, at the weekend? That is the end of part one of The Ruck. We'll be back tomorrow, where we'll be talking about the future of the game. At that point, there will be some clarification on why we are giggling and talking about the world in 2044. Part two of The Ruck will be available for download tomorrow.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com.
That's OSEAMalibu.com code MOM.